welcome to the Women for Election podcast. Today we're going to be hearing Deputy Mary Lou MacDonald chatting with Martina Fitzgerald. Recent elections, lockdowns, programme for government negotiations, life in opposition. All of those we'll be hearing about. You'll find us wherever you find your podcasts. Please do share on social media. And if you can at all donate to Women for Election, please have a look at our website, womenforelection.ie. Hi, everyone. You're all very welcome. You're delighted. We're delighted you could be here. Today, we're going to be hearing from two women, both of whom are very familiar and both of whom we almost feel like we know. So I think it's going to be a fascinating chat. For those of you who don't know me or who I haven't yet had the chance to meet, my name is Kireen. I'm the CEO of Women for Election and delighted you could be here today. Martina really needs no introduction. Martina, all of you will be familiar with Martina on our screens from her time with RTE. She's also, of course, a best-selling author with her book, Madam Politician. And she more recently has been doing some fascinating research looking at the US Congresswomen and the changes that have or haven't been happening there recently. And Martina is going to be talking to Mary Lou, who is one of those rare Irish politicians who doesn't actually need a surname, because when you say Mary Lou, everyone knows who we're talking about. But Deputy Mary Lou MacDonald, who I suppose is fair to say had a brilliant election campaign recently, although it does seem like quite some time ago at this point. She's Uachtaráin Hinn Féin, and she's also the first female leader of the opposition. We're delighted both of you could join us today. We're very much looking forward to the conversation. But just before I hand over, if I could just give one quick plug. Women for Election, as with all organisations in the midst of this crisis, has been badly hit in terms of our fundraising. For those of you who are joining us, if you can at all donate, we'd really appreciate it. And if you go onto the website, you'll see the big donate button there. It's very straightforward and easy. So with that, I'll hand over to Martina and Mary Lou.
Thanks very much, Kireen. Well, I'm delighted to be here today and to talk to Mary Lou MacDonald, one of the most high-profile and senior politicians in the country, the president of Sinn Féin. And today's conversation is going to centre around her insights, her experiences, and also the issues, the challenges, the opportunities for women in politics. And I suppose the starting point has to be female representation in the Dáil and Cabinet. Now, Mary Lou MacDonald, you're among 36 women in this Dáil, which means 22.5% of the Dáil is comprised of women, or if you put it another way, almost 80% of Dáil deputies are men. And in the Cabinet, 4 out of 15 of the Cabinet ministers are women. That is the highest level of representation in Cabinet, and it was first recorded in 2014. Mary Lou MacDonald, if you were leading this government or leading Sinn Féin into government, how many women would you have pointed in terms of the Sinn Féin ministers? Would you have made it a gender balanced in terms of your Sinn Féin ministers?
Well, Martina, it's great to see you again. And I'm delighted that we're having this conversation, and no better place to start than the composition, the gender profile of the Dáil and indeed the Cabinet. I appointed our own front bench there last week or the week before, and of 15 of us, there are 7 women. So it's almost perfectly gender balanced. In terms of representation in the Dáil generally and at Cabinet, it's very clear that there is work to be done. You can only have a gender-based Cabinet if you have a gender-based composition across the Parliament, because you have to be elected in the first instance to qualify to serve in that capacity. So I think a number of things need to happen, but chiefly amongst them, there has to be a real determination, Martina, beyond tokenism, to actually ensure balance in at Cabinet level and at every level in political life. And you will well know, I'm not making this point to be tokenistic in terms of having female faces or female voice or to take the bad look of very male politics. But because we know, and all of the research domestically and internationally reflects the fact that representative bodies make better decisions. Politics is better when it is gender balanced and regionally balanced to the best of your ability. And very often the question is asked, well, should it be gender or ability? Let me say that it is absolutely possible and necessary to have gender balance and to have big, big talent at cabinet level and across politics.
Now, you know, I'm going to ask you after that, is that a pledge that you might have made a gender balanced or you can't give that guarantee?
Well, no, I mean, my commitment absolutely is to gender balance across political life generally and at the level of cabinet. So, no, that would be absolutely my determination. But I would counter the question with this question or this observation, and it is this, it's one thing if you win an overall majority and you are forming the government on your own. It's an entirely different matter if you are in a coalition or a partnership arrangement with others. But as a matter of principle, I'm very committed to gender parity and representation. And I know myself, after many years in public and political life, that women are really, really good at politics. We are a necessary part of the picture. And you cannot claim to have a truly representative democracy with women still so absent. I mean, almost 80%, as you said, Martina, of Dáil deputies are men. And fair play to the men, and we love our men and we need men in public life, obviously, but there is still something we're getting something fundamentally wrong when only 20% of the parliament are women. We were lucky in the last election. Kieran was very kind to acknowledge that it was a very good campaign for us, and we had of the 37 Sinn Féin TDs, 13 are women. So, yes. And that's still not perfect, by the way. We have work to do. I have work to do on this.
And I'm going to come on to that. I'm first going to stay put for the cabinet. If you were in government or if you were Taoiseach, what portfolio would you have sought? And I note that women have never occupied finance, foreign affairs or defence. Would you have been interested in any of those, or did you have your mind set on any portfolio?
Not in particular, no. To be honest with you, we had set out a very comprehensive policy agenda. I'm very clear that we need to get affordability in housing. We need to crack a public healthcare system, childcare, all of those things. I noticed during the course of the campaign and the aftermath of it, time and again, the question was posed, could Mary Lou be the Taoiseach? Which is a question to which I sometimes answered, well, could I not be Taoiseach? I mean, is it written somewhere that, you know, the woman can't be Taoiseach? Each of the portfolios that you've instanced there, I would be interested in. However, if we were or are in government at any stage, I would have Piers Doherty in mind in terms of finance, because that's his expertise. But look, we have to build our mandate and we have to win sufficient support for those to be questions that I need to ask of myself.
So you didn't have your eyes set on any particular ministry?
No, not any particular ministry, although I mean the whole area of obviously equality and inclusion is something very close to my own heart. Obviously the health system needs very serious work. And of course, foreign affairs, it incorporating the North and the All-Ireland agenda. These are all areas of interest for me and for the party. But no, I hadn't my heart set on one particular portfolio, no.
Okay. And in terms of the Greens, they were quite innovative in terms of appointing Pippa Hackett from the Shannon to a junior ministry position. Would that be something you'd ever consider for in terms of a similar route for someone like Michelle O'Neill into cabinet?
Well, Michelle O'Neill has a big job to do in the North. I mean, she's the joint head of government. So no, I think Michelle has plenty on her plate for now. But certainly the route, not just to a junior or a super junior minister, but to the cabinet table through the Seanad is allowable. It's entirely legitimate, and I wouldn't rule it out. I think Michelle would be quite shocked if there was any suggestion that she would be upping sticks from Tyrone and the huge workload that she's carrying in the North and coming down here. So that's not in prospect, not for now. But eventually, Martina, we're going to have an All-Ireland Dáil in Parliament anyway. So they'll be coming from Tyrone and Armagh and Antrim and Derry and Down and Fermanagh too.
Within the first 10 minutes, you've managed to get that in. Okay. We're moving on, though. In terms of the Seanad, though, as well, I noted that of the Taoiseach's 11 appointees, the vast majority were women, but just one from outside of the government political parties, and that was Eileen Flynn. Again, if you were Taoiseach and you certainly wanted the job, would you reach out beyond the political party system? And what kind of women would you have appointed?
Well, I was delighted to see that Eileen was appointed, an extremely excellent appointment. And I really look forward to see her active in political life. I think she's going to bring something very significant to the table. Yes, I think it is very important for the Taoiseach of the day to go beyond the ranks of their own party. I think it is extremely important that we have representation from Northern Life. And I don't mean just nationalists or Republicans. I mean unionism too. And in fact, in the last Oireachtas, when there was an opening in the Seanad, you'll remember, Martina, that we supported and voted for Ian Marshall, himself a unionist, a former leader of the Ulster Farmers Union, and he was a really good senator. I mean, he comes from a very different political perspective from me, but a really valuable voice. And I think it was a missed opportunity not to have a voice from the North. And why not a woman? Why not women? So yes, that is an important feature. I think, you know, if we recognise that politics is still overwhelmingly male, if we recognise that our politics as of yet doesn't represent the real diversity across Irish life, if we recognise that Irish politics yet doesn't represent the kind of generational dynamic on the island as well, well then that gives you the clue as to kind of the kind of people that I think you need to go looking for. Talented people, able people to make
any
a
names?
Contribution through the Seanad.
Any names that come to mind?
No, and it would be really unfair to, unfortunately, on this occasion, I'm not in a position to make appointments, but I do have people in mind. And listen, there's no shortage of talent. It's not as if you'd have to ponder very deeply or search very far to find incredibly able people across every aspect of public and private life in Irish society. And real leaders, by the way, real leaders in the community, and regionally across the island, really inspirational people who, to be honest with you, I take great wisdom from and great succor from too.
Okay, so no clues yet. But in terms of Dáil representation, as you mentioned, you had a breakthrough election, 37 seats, and that certainly is a long journey from 1997, Caoimhín Ó Caoláin achieving or securing a seat back then. And also, Sinn Féin has the highest number of women in its Dáil ranks. It has 13. Now, overall, I was looking at the figures in terms of how many women you ran during those elections, during the general election, and it was just over 30. It was just around a third. Why did you not run more women, can I ask you?
Because in the election, as we were preparing, you recall we had a great general election. We also had a very challenging European and local elections in the summer previously. So, in making preparations, I suppose you cut your cloth according to what you think is your measure. And the truth is, we should have run more candidates generally. Certainly I would have liked us to run more women, and we will. I mean, I won't be happy until we're running, you know, 50-50 parity gender-based slates. You have to convince women to actually come forward. And I know that sounds like a very basic thing, but you can only have women as candidates when women are ready, willing and able to put themselves forward. And I think we've done a reasonably good job in the party on that, but I'm under no illusions that we still have work to do. So we ran good candidates, very strong candidates, got lots of them elected. But I want us to be ambitious next time around.
And what would you see as the biggest barrier in terms of women coming forward, you know, to get into national politics?
I think, and I mean, we're all familiar with the five C's, isn't it? I would kind of ditch the five C's for one P, and that P is power. I think we have a psychology and a culture in Irish politics that power and politics is done by men. And it's an unspoken thing, but I think there's nearly an assumption that it's a male space, that, you know, And I think the apparatus of politics and even sometimes the articulation of politics can be a little bit alien or off-putting to women. And I think, therefore, sometimes, therefore the system and the structures sort of keep us out or keep us a bit alienated from politics. And then we second guess ourselves. I mean, I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I notice that a man, when approached to run for election, and to their credit, this is to the credit of the male of the species, says, yes, I can do that. Absolutely. We as women tend to second guess ourselves and to identify all the small bits of the job that we figure we're not 100% sure of, we're not entirely sure of. And I think we have a challenge to actually stop doing that and to actually seize opportunities and to be very clear that we want our place at the table. But for us to have that place at the table, two things need to happen. The system needs to let us in. They need to give way. But then we also have to have not just the confidence, but the determination to actually take a chance and to go and to do and to learn by doing.
Now, party culture is very important, and some people, some representatives, elected representatives from your own party, male and female, have left. I think it's a dozen or so citing allegations of harassment or bullying. Do you think your party has a culture of bullying?
No, but I know that we are like many, many other large organisations that you have to manage. You have to manage the culture, and you have to manage relationships, and you have to have procedures and processes that are clear, that are clearly understood, and that are implemented and followed up on. And you're right to say some colleagues left, and I regret that to this day, Martina. The last thing I want is for anybody to leave, and certainly I want the party to be a place for every member, that they experience the excitement, the satisfaction, the collegiality of working in politics and getting things done. And for the very most part, Sinn Féin is that place. But you're right, some people had bad experiences. So we moved to correct that, to be honest about identifying it and correcting it. But let me tell you this. This is something that we will always have to work on. This is something that any organization will have to work on, because human beings are human beings, and people can strike very good, positive relationships, but equally people can fall out and strike negative relationships. But as to there being some deep-rooted culture in the organization, no. I mean, we're a huge membership now. We're urban and rural, women and men, all across the generations. And Sinn Féin people are very, very good people, people of goodwill.
Now, in terms of your own personal experiences, have you had any gendered experiences or experienced any sexism in your own political life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't think you can be a woman in this world and not. And do you know what? Very often, it's not intentionally malicious. So let me give you an example of a typical thing that happens, and it has still happened to me, and it will probably still happen to me, will happen to me for all the days that I'm doing politics. And it's this: you're in a meeting, and it's predominantly male, and the men will automatically talk to each other. In many circumstances, you may come into a meeting, you could be the senior person there, but if it's a very male environment, the conversation will be directed to the man. I'm sure lots of people listening to this conversation recognize this. And again, I think that is not... that's not done out of badness or malice. That's just kind of behaviors. That's culture, you know, gendered behavior. I've never had any really, really ugly experiences of direct harassment or bullying myself. I'm happy to tell you. But I do know that some others, that's not been the case. But nonetheless, I am a woman, and I'm a woman operating in what is still, unfortunately, a very male environment. So you're always conscious of that. In fact, I remember my first day in the Dáil. I don't know if I told you this before, Martina, in different conversations, and I had come from the European Parliament, which was huge and actually quite balanced. And you go into the Dáil, and the chamber, actually, when you're in it, is quite small. And when it's full, if you're having a Barney with somebody across the floor, you could nearly stretch out your hand and touch them on the nose, you know. And it was only when we were all assembled and we were sitting down, and I looked across the the ranks of the Dáil that you realise, God, you really are in a minority here. You know, the maleness of it is very obvious to you.
And in terms of, I'm going to move on to that issue, but before that, as a party leader, do you think you're treated differently?
Well, I think you're written about differently. I think you're remarked upon differently. I've been fascinated. I love language. And I'm always mindful of how people are written up and how things are expressed. And you will notice kind of things said that have been written about me. And by the way, by others, other women in leadership, you know, about throwing your toys out of the pram or being shrill, or there's kind of a language that is deployed to describe us. And I think sometimes that's done intentionally. I think other times it's not. It's actually almost an instinctive thing. But yes, we're certainly written about differently. And the expectations of us are different too. Yeah.
Now, there have been numerous studies, and it's an issue I was researching in America on you as Congresswomen, and it's online abuse. And it's a very pertinent issue on both sides of the Atlantic. But the women there have suffered, senior Congresswomen have suffered a lot of abuse, threats of violence, threats of rape. And it's very difficult. You can understand why so many people don't want to either stay in politics or enter politics because of that. Can I ask you, there was a research done recently by the Irish Times, and 31 members of the Oireachtas who responded to the survey said they have received online threats of physical violence, and 17 said they reported those threats of violence to the Gardaí. And there was also a number of 12, 8 of whom were women, had received harassing or intimidatory sexual material online. And again, four of whom were women, made reports to the Gardaí. Have you ever experienced, I know you have said in the past you've experienced threats, have you ever experienced that kind of threats made to you personally?
Yes. Yes, I have. And I remember the survey in question. I don't think actually I filled that survey out, but I remember it being reported at the time. The answer to those questions is yes, in all cases. And it is obviously unacceptable and repulsive to threaten and to target people. And it's all the more so when it's on the basis that they're a woman, and for some misguided reason, therefore, in the minds of some, that you become a target for this type of abuse. I've had occasion to report threats to the authorities, to the Gardaí. And I absolutely understand how unnerving that is. I mean, I'm doing this, you know, a good long time. You know, I'm an experienced political figure, and it upsets and unnerves me. So I can imagine for people new to politics or people considering coming into political life that it could be hugely off-putting. But I want to say this, do you see, as unpleasant as that is, it is something that you can manage, and it is something that you can seek help from the authorities with, and you're not alone in that experience. And it's very, very important that nobody, at least of all us women, are, if you like, bullied off the pitch. It's so important that we stand our ground. It doesn't take from the upset that happens naturally when you have a situation like that. But also, those are the exception and not the norm. You know what? Most people are so decent, and even people who don't necessarily vote for you or who don't necessarily share your political view, people are really, really decent and lovely and polite, and it's a small toxic minority that engage in the kind of thing that you've described.
Can I ask you the scale or level of threats that you received? Have you received many death threats or threats of rape or anything of a sexual nature?
Yeah, no, all of, yes, at different times.
So many death threats, I'm trying to get an idea of, you know, of the scale of abuse or threatening behaviour towards a female politician of your stature.
Well, look, I have had several. I mean, I couldn't even count, but it has happened to me, yes. And I don't want to, and I'm not suggesting that you're trying to sensationalise this or whatever. Yeah. It has happened to me. I'm here. I'm very much alive. I'm going about my work, and I feel very secure and safe in myself. Those are very unpleasant experiences, but they are the exception. They are absolutely the exception and not the rule. But yes, I've had those experiences, and yes, I've had to report on occasion those matters to the authorities over the years. Yes,
and some have experienced threats towards their families. Have you ever had that? That would be equally, if not more, concerning.
Yes to both questions. Yes, that has happened to me, and yes, that is absolutely the pits. And people who do that, I don't have words to describe my view of them.
I say that because, of course, against the backdrop of the murder of Joe Cox, and also because so many female politicians in the UK, did not run in the last elections. And yeah, some of them cited death threats and threats of rape and racist abuse. And we've seen Diane Abbott was subjected to huge levels of abuse, mm-hmm, as well. So that is an issue for women in politics.
For sure. I know Diane well. She's a very, very fine parliamentarian, really, and a very distinguished person, as you know, Martina, in British political life. So I know that she has had very, very unacceptable experiences. And look, all of us have the right to go about our business safely. The level of abuse, and you mentioned Joe Cox, who left a young family behind her. I mean, my God, what an ordeal for that family. And I know that had a huge chilling effect across the water in terms of people, women feeling insecure. We don't have things at that pitch on this side of the pond. And I think we have to strive for some kind of civility in political life, but at a minimum for safety and for security. But I want to emphasize, because we're talking to women and we've women listening who clearly have an interest in political life, and just to emphasize again that yes, these things can happen, but they are the exception and not the rule. And women should not, I would appeal to women not to kind of give way to that sense that that either this isn't a life for you or that it's not safe. It is safe. But of course you have to use your common sense, and you have to deploy every mechanism to ensure that you are safe. And if you feel that you're not, well, then you need to step forward and go to the appropriate authorities.
Now, some politicians from other parties have also pointed to online abuse by some Sinn Féin supporters online. And that was raised in the Irish Times survey, that people had mentioned confidentially that there is an aggressive online activity that comes from some of your supporters. And one politician, Fianna Fáil Senator Malcolm Byrne, cited in the article that he would love to hear you say to those supporters who are engaged in this activity to stop attacking individuals. Do you believe there's a problem? Do you want to call it out? Do you think you should call it out?
I have no difficulty calling out anybody who is aggressive or abusive to people online at all. And that includes, by the way, people who would support me or Sinn Féin or vote for us or share an analysis of life with us. That's not acceptable behaviour. And I say that as a person who is subjected very regularly, I mean very, very regularly, to not just forceful or forthright commentary, but sometimes downright abusive, desperate stuff. And in some cases that is from, you know, political opponents. You know, it's wrong, whoever does it. But can I also say this, that there's a bit of mythology propagated by some around this notion of Shinner bots and, you know, Sinn Féin. Can I tell you, Sinn Féin people are teachers and doctors and plumbers and painters and, you know, mammies and daddies and students. They've more to be doing than signing up to be so-called Shinner bots and spending half their day online. So I think there's a bit of mythology around that. I do accept that it can be a bit of a wild west on social media. And of course, I absolutely condemn that, whoever it's directed at. And it's been directed at me. And occasionally, not all the time, because I haven't the time to be at it, but every once in a while, I will look at my own social media platforms. And if there's aggressive or abusive behavior, I say to people, please don't come on my page. Please don't direct that sort of stuff along here. By all means, have a debate, give a commentary, level a criticism if that's what you wish to do. But keep it clean and keep it civil.
And are you going to be more proactive about that in terms of postings that you see come from people who purport to support your party?
I think I'm very, very clear in terms, and I think I have been clear in terms of the standards that I believe are appropriate and necessary on social media and elsewhere. But obviously, I'm not going to police social media. I don't think anybody could do that. I don't think you could ask a political representative or the leader of any political party to monitor social media. I can't do that, but I can be absolutely clear in saying that you can have differences of opinion. You can have a very lively, very direct political debate, but you don't have to go at it in a way that's that amounts to harassment or just rudeness. I mean, I think politeness and all of those things actually stand for something.
Now, moving along to something that was in the news recently, and you have suspended all party activity in Dublin South West, and that follows the nomination of Paddy Houlihan as mayor of South Dublin County Council. Pardon me. You were not aware that was going to happen. Of course, this follows the fact that he was suspended from the party earlier in the year over comments made about women and Leo Varadkar. And at the time, you described those comments as wrong and vile and beyond offensive. And you also said you found them upsetting. I think what many people might find surprising is that he was back in the party. And I know there's due process, mm-hmm. and we have to be mindful of that. But what do you say to those who are surprised, given some of the comments that he made, that he is back in Sinn Féin?
Well, look, the commentary was what it was. And at the time, I expressed my view on it, and my views haven't changed. And you're right then, we have a rule book in the party. I mean, I don't lead the party by diktat. Every political organisation, you have a constitution, you have rules. And those rules include disciplinary and grievance procedures. The disciplinary procedures are mediated independently, so that there can be no question at any stage as to the due process and natural justice. And that process was gone through, and the councillor was suspended for a number of months, cautioned, was left in absolutely no doubt as to the unacceptability of that type of commentary. It not alone does it run against the grain of what we're all about, Sinn Féin policy and all the rest of it, but it falls way below the standards that you would expect from a public representative. So all of that has been thrashed out. I'd say this also, that people can do things that are wrong, and they can mess up, and they go through the process, they take their sanction, and then fairness dictates that you allow a person to get back on and get back on with their work, and Councillor Houlihan has to do that. And I know certainly from the community that he is elected from, he's very well regarded, and he needs to do his job. But he's in no doubt that the commentary was utterly unacceptable, and I acted very quickly to deal with the issue at that time.
Okay, and there's a review at the moment. In terms of female politicians, and we are having some questions coming in, but I want to just ask you a few other questions before I go to those. In terms of female politicians, we don't know very much about your private life. And is that something that you're very keen to keep private? We know when people certainly are elevated to a certain level in national politics, more details emerge about their family and their personal lives, and they will attract attention. What's your own, you know, belief about that?
Well, I think a private life is by definition private, you know, and I'm the public figure in my family. The rest of my family aren't, but my children aren't, my husband isn't. And I like that they have a normal life and they get on with things. Anybody who needs to know everything about me knows it. So I do accept that as a public figure, obviously people want to have some sense, if you don't get me wrong, like I'm not a robot, you know. I think it's important that that people know that I'm a mother, that I have teenage children, that, you know, I'm a dub, and all of those things. But yeah, I think there are pieces of yourself and your family that you keep for yourself. And I actually don't believe that there is a duty on public figures to, you know, spill the beans and set out everything. I think, you know, all of us as people, you know, there's things that are private and you keep them private.
So we're not going to see a full page spread anytime soon of your family.
Well, listen, can I tell you, I have teenage children. I think they would be horrified at the very prospect of doing, you know, a full spread at home with mom, I don't think is what they have in mind.
Okay. And what about your children pursuing a career in politics? Would you recommend it?
That's entirely up to them. They're both very independent thinkers, and they have their own ideas. Obviously, they're coming up in a political household, in a Republican household. So those values of equality and respect and all of that, I hope we have successfully inculcated in them. We're United Irelanders. I hope we've inculcated that as well. But they are very, very much independent thinkers. And sometimes they are the ones who challenge me most with the why and the how and all the rest. And I like it that way. And certainly if either one of them was interested in being politically active or advancing, you know, in the political world, fair play to them. But
what did they challenge you on recently? Out of curiosity, a bit bold, but what did they challenge you on recently?
Well, I tell you, one of the conversations in our house was at the time of the Black Lives Matters protest. And they got quite animated on the issue of statues and whose statues were up and whose statues were down. And we had a discussion around whether or not you take down offending statues, how you remember history. And they have a very, very clear-cut view that if you're one of the bad guys, take your statue down, consign your statue to, I don't know, the scrap heap of history. So I was trying to, you know, give a bit of nuance around, you know, inclusivity and how you have to actually honour history and to advance equality and liberation. You have to accept the bad bits, you know, or the alternative bits as well. You know, that's the totality of life. But Martina, they challenged me on everything from A to Z. So,
okay, in terms of Yvonne, of some of the questions now that are coming in, Yvonne Galligan, I'm presuming that's the political scientist Yvonne Galligan and Director of Equality and Inclusion in TU Dublin. I could be wrong, but I suspect it is not. I'm not. She's questioning about the introduction of gender quotas at local level, and would you commit to introducing an extension of the national legislation in time for the next local elections? Because many people would view, I think, that it was a missed opportunity last time round.
Yeah, I would agree with Yvonne on that. I think that makes perfect sense, particularly because, as we all know, for so many people in political life, the starting ground, the place where you learn your craft, is in the community, in community politics and in local politics, in local authorities. I think it's a logical extension. Like, it doesn't make sense to have quotas, you know, at the level of the Dáil, and, you know, and not have them locally. So, yes, I think that is very worthwhile, and I think it's something that we will pursue.
Now, in terms of another question here, what steps would you recommend for young women who would like to get more involved in politics but don't have any family friend connections in the area? Okay, that's a practical question for someone who may be interested in pursuing a political career.
I would say, first of all, you have to have a real sense of what it is that you want to achieve. Like, what's your politics? So for me, I'm my politics is of the left. I'm a Republican. I'm a United Irelander, and that frames how I see the world and the things that I would prioritize and pursue and how I would pursue them. So, you know, there's this whole thing of all politics are the same and all politicians are the same. We're actually not. And politics is all about diversity of thought and opinion. It's about what policy looks like. It's about how do you get the best result? What's the destination? Who does government and public policy serve and how? So you have to have a sense, first of all, of yourself, of who you are, what matters to you and what you want to achieve. And then you have to look at your options. I mean, joining a political party is one of them. I would certainly strongly recommend it. And anybody who shares my kind of political views, I'd urge you to join Sinn Féin. But I'm also conscious that you won't necessarily start off in a political party. It could be that you begin your political activism on an issue or a campaign that you care deeply about. But I suppose the overall advice I'd give, Martina, is get active. Find your channel and your place. And you don't need to be from a political dynasty. You don't. I'm the first person in my party to ever, or in my family to ever have run for political office. So you don't have to come from a political dynasty. What you need to have is a sense of purpose, like what matters and how, what am I going to do about it? And what's the best space and the best place for me to be to achieve those things?
Now, I'm going to group some of the questions coming in because they're all on a similar theme. Laura Harmon, who was a candidate in the Shannon elections, she asks about the supports needed to be put in place in addition to quotas to support women for election and in terms of, you know, keeping them in the system, supporting them when they're in there. Leila, who's also involved before in UCD and another organisation, she has asked, she'd like to know what are the barriers, again, for women who are considering a career in politics? And how could they be broken down? And the chair of Women for Election, Alison Crozier has asked, considering the glacial pace of change in reaching gender balance, is there one systemic, major systemic change that you could make and make it now? And what would it be?
Okay. So maybe to start at the start with Norma. I think...
Laura, yeah.
Sorry, Nora.
Laura Harmon.
Nora, hello, Norma. Nora. So I think actually when Women for Election came to be and started running, you know, mentoring and training and all of that, I think certainly the value of that approach has become very evident. I think for us to have the kind of mentoring and supports that we need for women to advance in political life, we have to come at it in a very sisterly fashion. And by that, I mean, we all have to be prepared to learn from each other and we need to learn how to give of ourselves. So I want, obviously, more, you know, Republican, left-wing, progressive women in political life. But I accept that women come from all political perspectives. And I think one of the values of Women for Election is that it provides a forum in which your political orientation is one thing, but you qualify because you are a woman and because we're so underrepresented. I want more women, you know, in here, full stop. So, and we need to figure out how we do that. I think the state and the Exchequer could make more deliberate efforts in terms of funding streams and resources for training, for development, for mentoring. I don't think we have to spend a fortune on it, but I know all of that requires resources and we shouldn't be relying on, you know, philanthropy or the good deeds and works of the few. I think if we have identified in terms of quotas that this is a systemic issue, and therefore there has to be a systemic response to it. And that maybe brings me to Alison, when you're saying, you know, what's the one big systemic change? And this might be a surprising one to offer up, but this is my view at this point. In addition to all the other things that we are doing and need to do, I would drop the voting age. I would drop it to 16. And I would engage a younger generation in our political life, and I would make it a thing for younger people and in particular for younger women. And I tell you what brought me to this, strongly to this view in terms of gender politics. I was watching the referendum in Scotland, you know, their independence referendum, and on that occasion, you recall, they dropped their voting age. And the consequences of that for the campaign, never mind your view, good, bad or indifferent, yes or no, but for the campaign itself, it literally transformed it. And it struck me that in one fell swoop, it had managed to engage young people and women in a way that a whole pile of agonizing, you know, for decades and generations hadn't. So I think we need to send, Alison, we need to send out the message that politics is open, that it's open to young people, that it's open to women. And I think dropping the voting age would be a really decisive intervention. And I think a popular intervention amongst those groups that we need to engage and involve. What was Leila's specific question again? I'm sorry, Leila, if I...
No, Leila was also looking at the issues to support women in politics,
yes,
and the barriers and that general issue, which I think you've discussed. Now, two people have also come forward, and I'm grouping a few questions here. Mavis Sullivan has talked about supportive networks for female politicians, and also Deirdre Mortel, who's also involved with Women for Election. She has asked, when will Sinn Féin join the Women's Caucus in the Oireachtas? If not, why not? Now, I know that Sinn Féin has had a mixed history with the Women's Caucus, and it was one of my later questions, because at a time you wanted staff to be involved as well.
Yeah.
But don't you have to get involved and buy in completely if you're going to see change?
Well, of course you do. And in fact, one of our colleagues in the North was the chair of the Women's Caucus. And in fact, Sinn Féin women did get involved with the caucus in the Dáil. But it wasn't without a comment and debate within the ranks of our women, because there was a view or a question mark as to whether or not the caucus could actually be a space to actually affect change. And that is still a question mark for some of our women. I mean, I personally take the view that every space that you can avail of, even if you achieve one objective, it's one thing done and it's one thing achieved. So that's the view I would take. I would suggest that as and when we get back to whatever normal politics is going to look like, you will find that there will be Sinn Féin women, of course, involved in the caucus. But just remember this also, that all of us we're a grassroots organisation. We come from very diverse kind of backgrounds, but what you notice when you look across our team, and particularly the women, is they come from community and grassroots activism. So they know their beans on this one, and I'm certainly sure that they will want the caucus to be something dynamic and to actually agree a program that amounts to more than, you know, just meeting up, and, you know, they'll want big issues brought to it. And I know there's women in other political parties who similarly share that view.
But as a leader of your party, wouldn't that really show solidarity? And you were talking about sisterhood or sisterly behavior. Wouldn't that really demonstrate it in action if you were to become involved at a senior level with the caucus?
Yeah, well, certainly. And I think that the caucus itself can then examine how it extends its reach. I mean, one of the controversies for some of the Sinn Féin women was the idea of excluding, you know, political staff. You know, if this is a political space for women in the Oireachtas, some of my colleagues had a very strong view that yes, the elected people need to be there, but it needed to have a broader reach than that. So these aren't insurmountable things. The core piece around networks for women is a point very well made. That is absolutely necessary for us.
So we might see you at the next meeting of the caucus.
Well, who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? Can I ask you, what for Mary Lou MacDonald after politics? How long do you expect to stay in political life? And I remember asking Leo Varadkar this some time ago when his answer changed years later in terms of how long he'd stay in when he became leader. So it is a tricky question for a leader of a party. How long do you see yourself in political life, and what would you be doing if you weren't in political life or after political life?
Well, I'll always be political, and I hope that for as long as I live and breathe, I will always be politically active. But I mean, no job ever lasts forever. So the only answer I can give you is not forever. I'm in my job now as leader for 2 years. I think I've hit my stride, or I'm hitting my stride now. I have a huge job of work to do over the next number of years. Certainly, this decade now is a very significant decade for political life and for Sinn Féin. And of course, bear this in mind, Martina, our Ordesh decides who the leader is. So I can't be arrogant or saying I'll stay for so long. Ultimately, the membership will decide my longevity or otherwise.
Your predecessor had a particularly long leadership, and I was just wondering, would you envisage that kind
of stay in politics? Crikey, no, absolutely not. Gerry was an exceptional leader, and he came from very specific and exceptional circumstances. But no, 30 years is not the kind of timeline I have in mind. I can confirm that for you.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to return to Kieran, and thank you very much, Deputy Mary Lou MacDonald, for your time and for your insights and for answering our questions, frankly, but not always giving us the great insights into some of your ideas behind the scenes. But thank you very much.
Thank you,
and the very best luck.
Huge thanks to both Martina and to Mary Lou. I think that was a very broad-ranging interview, covered an awful lot, with great honesty about life and politics and party politics as well. Of course, Women for Election would always say that we need better funding organisationally and in general training for women to ensure that we see more women in politics. And it was great to hear Deputy Mary Lou MacDonald speak about the importance and the impact of the Women for Election approach and the value of our approach in that. So apart from, once again, thanking both Martina and Mary Lou, I think that is all that we need to do today. Apart from, of course, just to say it is great to see that you've recovered from the virus, because it's not been an easy time. It is great to see you back in action again.
Huge thanks to our guests today, Mary Lou MacDonald and Martina Fitzgerald. Hopefully you've enjoyed listening to them, and listen back to all of our podcasts, which you can find wherever you find your podcasts, on social media and on womenforelection.ie.